From the Sky News Centre at 6, a drug-addicted care home manager has been found guilty of killing one of her residents. Registered nurse Rachel Baker stole medication from the elderly at Parkfields Residential Care Home in Somerset to feed her own addiction. She was convicted of the manslaughter of 97-year-old Lucy Cox, who she gave lethal doses of drugs to. Detective Superintendent Trevor Simpson from Avon and Somerset Police says this needn't have happened.
What she became is manipulative, and I think the sad thing is that there are opportunities for her to tell people and seek help, and she never took that, and she hasn't taken it throughout this trial either.
The mother and stepfather of an 8-year-old girl found hanged in her bedroom have been jailed for trial cruelty. Charlotte Avenel from Mansfield had severe learning difficulties and died in September last year. Nottingham Crown Court heard no one had been in her heavily soiled bedroom for weeks. Susan and Simon Moody admitted cruelty. The first week of electoral campaigning for Labour has been marred by the sacking of one of its own candidates. Stuart McLennan posted a series of offensive comments on Twitter in which he insulted pensioners, train travellers and used four-letter words about other parties' leaders. Well, with the polls suggesting hung Parliament is likely, tactical voting could prove key. Speaking to politics.co.uk, Gordon Brown's urged non-Tory voters to support a potential Liberal-Labour pact after the election.
You're not going to end up with one of the minor parties running the government, no matter how interesting some of the policies may be. So I think what he's saying is if you don't want a Conservative government, make sure you don't get one.
National Express is to offer half-price coach travel to members of the armed forces. The company says reservists, as well as medical, dental and university cadets, will also benefit from the scheme developed with the Ministry of Defence. And HSBC has apologised after misspelling the name of one of its local branches. A new sign was placed above the door of the bank in Lowestoft in Suffolk following a refurbishment. Bosses were left red-faced after customers pointed out an R had been wrongly added into the coastal town's name. That's the latest. I'm Ursula.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to BCFM's Friday Drive Time with me, Tony Gosling. Now we have a little item from a certain Billy Quain. Now, Billy used to pop in here every week and he's doing so again this week. Now, let's just have a little listen to what he's got to say. He does a programme which is the BCFM Arts programme every Saturday morning from 10 until 12, and he's now going to give us a little idea of some of the things that you're on for not too much money over this weekend and in the coming week.
Welcome back, folks. This is me, Billy Quain, taking you through what's on to do for not very much money. For the next few minutes, Tony has stepped out of the studio to gather some air and his thoughts before he comes back with a relaunch after I'm done. Now, if you feel like going down to the Arnold Feeney this weekend, then I would encourage you to do so. There is a season of films by the legendary Russian director Sergei Parajanov. They include acclaimed features and recent documentaries. Some screenings will be introduced by friends, collaborators and experts. If you would like further information on this and all the films therein, then log on to the internet www.parajanovfestival.co.uk or consult the Arnold Feeney website, which is arnoldfeeney.org.uk. On Thursday, there's a free event at 7:30 p.m. It's the Reading Room. You can present, discuss or simply learn more about creative work, which takes an interdisciplinary approach to language, both vocal and textual, from poetry and fiction to film, music, performance and visual art. This meeting is the first of an ongoing series of quarterly events and will include a contribution from the artist Emma Bennett in residence at the Arnold Feeney during April. If you would like to present your own work or that of a writer artist you admire, either contact Reading Room at arnoldfeeney.org.uk or just turn up on the evening. Now, for the lovers of Gilbert and Sullivan, from next Tuesday onwards, the Bristol Gilbert and Sullivan Operatic Society are presenting Patience, a brilliant satire of the prolific outpouring of aesthetic poetry, music, art and design in the 1870s and 80s. It's directed musically by Eric Wetherill and produced by John Telfer. If you would like tickets, you need to go to the internet. It's bristolgsos.co.uk or call 0117 907 8079 for tickets. Tickets are not available at the Redgrave box office for this event. At the Brewery Theatre, for one night only on Sunday the 11th, You have got Roger Llewellyn, written in a play written by David Stewart Davies, and it is called Sherlock Holmes, The Last Act. After the great success as Sherlock Holmes, The Tobacco Factory last year, Roger Llewellyn returns with his new and a very different play. The world's greatest fictional detective confronts his most complex case of all, his own psyche. That's 8 p.m. on April the 11th at the Tobacco Factory. Now, if you like your drama a little smaller, at the Brewery Theatre on Wednesday the 14th until Sunday the 18th of April, with a 7:30 start, there's a play written by Steve Hennessy called Waiting for Wilmot. Stepping out Theatre former member and photographer Ian Wilmot died in 2008. Group members go to great lengths to avoid being in our own productions. And did he really hate dancing? It promises to be great. Ernest and the Pale Moon by Les Enfants Terribles, in association with Pins and Needles Productions, is back at the Bristol Old Vic Studio from Thursday the 8th until Saturday the 10th of April at 8 p.m. It's £10 or £7 with concessions. After a sellout run at the Edinburgh Festival, award-winning theatre company Les Enfants Terribles, in association with Pins and Needles Productions, tour with a spine-chilling tale of obsession and murder from the writer Oliver Lanzi and the production of the musical team behind the Terrible Infants. And then from the 13th to the 17th of April, you have got Eurydice by Sarah Rule. ACT and Bristol Old Vic are bringing Project Underworld to the Basement as a unique performance event to complement the studio run of ACT Drum Theatre Plymouth Young Vic production of Eurydice by Sarah Rule. This is the European premiere of Eurydice, and the creative team behind the multi-award-winning hit The Brothers' Sighs. Now then, big shout out for the Tunnels next week. Ruby Turner, with support from Jocanda, are coming on the 16th of April. That will cost you £16, and it doors at 7:30. At Colston Hall this weekend, it is the Made in Bristol Spring Fair. It's free, and it runs from 11 a.m. until 4 p.m. on Saturday and Sunday. To mark the coming of spring, the Colston Hall this year will have a chance. You will have a chance to uncover the best in regional art, food and entertainment. Made in Bristol is a two-day celebration of gold standard local produce, art, craft and food. On Monday at the Colston Hall, you can go and see Ultravox. It will cost you £32, so I'm not sure if you're going to go. Electrostatic is on at the Colston Hall 2 on Wednesday the 14th of April at 8 o'clock. Tickets are £10 and £7. It's the Bristol Ensemble, and their boundary-defying contemporary classical season curated by Richard Bernard, Roger Huckle and Neil Farwell. It will feature James Macmillan's As Others See Us, Justin Laycock among Seven Hills, the Symphonia Concertante for piano and orchestra with piano soloist Philip Mead, Neil Farwell's Bloodlines and Richard Barnard's Six Moments Alone 5. I can see that Tony is jumping up and down outside the studio, mad eager to get back to his buttons, so with that I will sign off. If you would like further information or details on any of these shows, may I encourage you to listen in tomorrow morning between 10 a.m. and midday to the Bristol Arts Show, hosted by me, Billy Quain. I look forward to sharing 5 minutes of your time again next week. For now, have a great weekend.
That's Billy Quain there. And yeah, so he's on tomorrow morning between 10 and midday. Anyway, one man we didn't hear from in last week's special about Irish history and Mo Molum's role in the Good Friday Agreement was Sinn Féin's Martin McGuinness. What's he saying now the troubles are over? That's coming up later. And we have an eyewitness to police corruption during the raid nearly 10 years ago on British ex-Guantanamo prisoner Myzin Begg's Birmingham bookshop. Also, pictures of the legendary British actor Peter Wingard, who starred in great British TV dramas Department S and Jason King, was in the mail on Sunday recently. But what has one of Britain's finest living actors, who was frozen out of the profession after he was prosecuted in Cheltenham for indecency in the 1970s, got to say about the state of modern TV drama? Before all that, though, one third of Bristol City councillors are up for election. That's 23 out of our 70 councillors this May in this election. This is the local elections, including the city's only Green candidate. I'm just joined by Martin Summers now. Martin, we've got some of the statistics here about who's actually up for election. Can you just look at, first of all, the proportions? Which party has got most of the candidates up for re-election this time?
Well, I'm just reading off your list here, Tony. I mean, it looked as if There are Liberal Democrats look as if they have the most people up for re-election.
Okay, and how many and who is up for re-election?
9 Liberal Democrats are up for re-election. Some of the names, David Kitson, Peter Main, Mary Sykes, who we had on the programme a couple of weeks ago, Claire Campion-Smith, who we had on the programme not that long ago either, Gary Hopkins, another denizen of our programme.
Okay, could you just go through the actual wards that they're representing as well, please? We'll start with the Liberal Democrats.
Do you want me to run through the whole list of all the parties here and everything?
We'll start with the Liberal Democrats, since they're the biggest party that's actually having re-elections, and if you could just tell us the names and the wards that they're standing in.
Okay, so we've got, for the Liberal Democrats now, we're talking about David Kitson, standing for re-election in Bishopston, Peter Main in Brislington West, Mary Sykes in Hengrove, Claire Campion-Smith in Henlees, Gary Hopkins in Knowle, Sean Emmett in Lochlees, Sylvia Townsend in Redland, Timothy Kent in Whitchurch Park, and Alf Havoc in Windmill Hill. That's the Liberals.
Okay, and what's the next biggest party that's going to be
the
up for re-election?
The Conservatives have...
Well, that's interesting, because the Conservatives are actually the smallest of the three main parties, aren't they? But they've got more than Labour, I'm taking it. Are they up for re-election this time?
Yeah, I mean, it just depends. Not all the seats are up for re-election, are they? So it just depends what the cycle is. In Avonmouth, the Conservative Spud Murphy is up for re-election. Kevin Courtley in Bishopsworth, Barbara Lewis in Brislington East, who we've had on the programme, Mark Weston from Henbury, who's also been on the programme, Martin Kerry from Hawfield, David Morris from Stockwood, John Goulandris from Stoke Bishop, and Ashley Fox in Westbury-on-Trim.
Okay, what about the smallest number of seats, well, which are the Labour Party,
we've got Mark Bradshaw up for re-election in Bedminster, who we've just had on the first hour of the programme, Christopher Jackson in Filwood, Royston Griffey in Hartcliffe, John Bees in King's Weston, and Jenny Smith in Southmead.
Okay, so that at least gives you an idea of who's up.
These are the people who are up for re-election, and of course there'll be...
Charlie Bolton, who's the Green candidate.
Yes, he's mentioned here as well. I've forgotten, the Greens have got somebody up for re-election, Charlie Bolton. Of course, there will be lots of other candidates who will want to be unseating these sitting candidates. I don't think we've got a list of all the candidates for all the wards, have we?
No, I don't know if the nominations have even closed yet. In fact, the election's only officially just been announced, the general election anyway, it may be that nominations are still
open.
It
could very well be, of course, this vote will change the complexion of the council again, and that the Liberals will lose overall control, which could then lead to confusion and horse trading. I mean, they've only got a majority of two, so that could go.
Well, there are lots of the Liberal seats vulnerable, and I imagine the other parties will be looking at targeting some of those. What is it? How many seats is it? Nine seats, Liberal
yep.
seats. So all they'd have to do would be to overturn two of those to see some sort of at least political horse trading and negotiation.
Well, they'd lose overall control, wouldn't they, if that happened?
So is that the way that it works with the sort of... This is a little bit like a hung parliament, isn't it, that we've got in Bristol?
Well, not at the moment, because the Liberals have overall control, although under a PR system they wouldn't have overall control, which they pointed out when they've been on the programme. It's a bit tricky, isn't it? I mean, what the Labour group have put forward, I saw to Mark before the show, is this idea of having one election for all the seats in Bristol once every 4 years. But none of the other parties, for various reasons, wanted to agree with that proposal. But I can see the logic of that, you keep getting change on the council incrementally, because every couple of years you get another election and then it could change again. Whereas what you probably want is, you know, if the Liberals are the largest party, that they get 4 years to have a go, rather than keep looking over their shoulder and wondering whether they can actually do anything.
Well, also, relating to the elections, this time the national elections, we're having one of these wonderful new all-star TV debates, aren't we,
Thursday week here in Bristol.
So that's the 22nd of April, early evening apparently it's taking place. The location is secret, so obviously we would like to reveal where the location is here on this programme, so if anyone finds out, please do let us know. The meeting, or the debate, which is between the three main party leaders, in fact none of the minor parties are going to be involved in any of these debates, is going to be chaired by Sky is Sky News' political editor, Adam Bolton, who is a graduate of, amongst other places, John Hopkins Private US University. And he's also covered the US presidential debates, which seems to me no coincidence, Martin, because this is a kind of US-style idea, isn't it?
Yeah, the idea of having the party leaders, because that's what it's all about. They're going to be king, so let's have a choice of kings to choose from.
Do you think this is also the way that these elections are being spun in the media in this way, with just the three party leaders on the telly, is rather also reflects a sort of concentration of power towards the Prime Minister, whereas in the old days the idea was that you had a kind of consensus at the cabinet. Nowadays it's much more of a presidential style, king style leadership.
We have got a presidential style system, but without any checks and balances. I mean, effectively, both Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair were dictators. They didn't have to agree with anybody about anything. They decided everything, and everybody else just had to step into line. I think Gordon Brown's leadership style is not dissimilar. I think there's an awful lot of power in the hands of the Prime Minister these days. You know, I think, frankly, you know my views. I think we need to change the electoral system. I think we probably need a written constitution. You know, we can't just keep bodging along. Because also, what we're also doing is we're just having this kind of plebiscitary democracy where, you know, David Cameron could have the keys to number 10 in a few weeks' time and he just becomes dictator for 5 years. I mean, I don't know. And the same would be true if Brown
was. Well, if he's elected, he's not really a dictator, is
he? Well, yes, but he won't have a majority of the electorate behind him. That's fairly clear. They're on, you know, 40% minus in the opinion polls. So if they come to power with that kind of mandate, and they won't have a mandate in Scotland, and they won't have a mandate in Wales, and they won't have a mandate in Northern Ireland, you know, our system has become very, very creaky. And I agree with the Liberal Democrats about this, that we need to change the system so that it's more open, more competitive, and more voices can be heard. The problem with our current system is everything is funneled into one kind of narrow neck of debate, whereas in other countries which have a more proportional system, there's a much wider plurality of voices.
Now, Adam Bolton, who is the chap who's going to be moderating this prime ministerial candidates debate between David Cameron, Gordon Brown and Nick Clegg, is also married to a New Labour spin doctor. I mean, it seems like there's a rather tiny number of people. I'm also someone who's very seems to be pro-New Labour anyway. The other thing is that the subject matter of this one of the three debates, the one that's happening in Bristol, is going to be international issues such as Afghanistan, Iraq, Europe and China. What are your thoughts about that content, Martin?
I think it's interesting that they've chosen here. Bristol to do the international debate because, I mean, obviously in Bristol there's been a very active anti-war movement, very active movement in support of the Palestinian struggle. I mean, Bristol has got lots of international connections. I mean, I know loads of people have been out to Chiapas in Mexico to play football from the Eastern Cowboys and Cowgirls. I mean, people in Bristol, it's an international city. We are interested in international issues. We remember we had the Somali Voice people on our programme talking about political issues in Somalia. I think Bristol's a good place to have the international debate, although we understand that the people who are going to be selected to be in the discussion are just going to be selected randomly, and you can't actually apply to go and be in the debate. You will either be selected at random or you won't be.
Well, they're saying it's at random, but it doesn't seem like it is, because we had a leak in the Evening Post a few weeks ago with a woman who said that her age was 50, and she was told by one of the people who were working for Sky that that was too old.
Well, I'm not quite sure how they are selecting the audience.
Well, this is a very important question, isn't it?
It is, yes.
I think it needs to be absolutely open and accountable how they're doing that. The other thing is, it's interesting that they've kept the location secret, because that means that it seems to me, like it anyway, that they're expecting some possible trouble there.
Well, there won't be trouble. I mean, as soon as we know where the demonstration is, where the debate is, lots of people who've got issues, especially international issues, will want to go and show their feelings probably outside the debate. I think that's quite likely. If there are any police officers listening, you know, don't be surprised if people turn up with some protest placards and what have you. That's pretty much what one might expect. If we can't actually get into the debate, people will want to have their say outside the venue, wherever it is.
Well, what about the whole principle, though, that many of the minor parties, some of which, for example, UKIP, does very, very well in the European elections, which are proportional representation. We're not seeing anybody from UKIP on any of these TV debate panels, are we?
I think there's a real problem there, because you've got you know, we've got the three major English parties here, but of course, you know, in Wales or Scotland, the SNP or Plaid Cymru would certainly qualify to be in such a debate. And you've got lots of other parties, your Green Party, you know, there's a whole plethora of parties. I think if we had a more proportional system, I don't know whether we'd be able to have this kind of discussion anymore. I mean, we'd be moving away from a prime ministerially focused system anyway.
In a way,
so
this
wouldn't necessarily be the same kind of game as we're playing.
In a way, this style of TV debate with only, you know, three debates with the three main leaders, the three main parties involved, is sort of almost buttressing this first past the post system, isn't it? That concentrates the hands and the power of the main parties.
Well, I mean, apart from the fact that the Liberals are being allowed to be on the programme. I mean, in previous generations, the Liberals would have been excluded, and it would have been a straightforward Labour Tory ding-dong.
Well, there is something called the Representation of the People Act, and I would imagine that the Liberals, as Plaid Cymru and the SNP did a few weeks ago, would threaten legal action at the very least about not being represented, because obviously most people will actually be making their minds up on who to vote for, at least they may well be, by one of these, you know, three TV debates, and it's the main way that the political parties have of actually reaching ordinary voters in the run-up to the election.
It is, and I'm a bit disturbed about the presidential nature of these debates. People need to recognise that politics is not just about having a brilliant leader and they go off and do it and you just sit back at home. Politics, as we've been trying to be pushed on this programme week after week, is a nitty-gritty business, and it requires ordinary citizens to take an interest and get involved. And it's not just about the superstars strutting up on the stage, you know, in front of the TV lights. But nevertheless, I mean, you've got to have some kind of debate somehow, and you know, we might argue about the framework for this debate. I mean, certainly the question we raise about how the audience is going to be chosen is very important, because if the audience are vetted, like we're living in North Korea or something, so you've only got a vetted audience of safe people in the auditorium, well, that would be worrying. But
certainly the news that's leaked out so far about this 50-year-old woman being told she's too old to be on there is not good, is it?
Well, it might be that they've already got their quota for people over 50. Do you see what I mean? Yes. That's possibly what's going on there. Yeah, we need to clarify this.
Yes, but hang on a minute. This was right at the very beginning, when the very first few people were being asked about whether they wanted to be on or not. And before we get off the subject of the power of television to frame the way we think, the Thai government, this is one of the stories in the news for the last week or so, has shut down a protesters' TV network in a bid for normality, so-called normality. At least this is from the Times yesterday. Sean Powell in Bangkok. The Thai government has taken decisive action to close down the propaganda machine, so-called, of the anti-government protesters. But an official spokesman has continued to insist that force would not be used to disperse the crowds now besieging the nation's capital in their thousands. And I noticed today that there's been a massive besieging of this satellite TV station by the people, literally thousands and thousands of ordinary people in Thailand, in order to try and get their views across. What are your thoughts about the role of TV in revolutions, Martin?
Well, they clearly are central. I mean, media is a very important part of any political struggle. If you think back to the revolution in Romania in 1989, the seizure of the TV stations was a key revolutionary act, as
well.
But
what about British artillery taking out Iraqi television transmitters?
Well,
I remember seeing pictures of that as well.
Yes,
really,
and Al Jazeera being knocked out in Baghdad and in Afghanistan by the Americans.
The story we had earlier on about the Reuters cameraman who was shot by these American helicopter pilots.
Yeah, well, as Stanley McChrystal, the head of the US forces in Afghanistan, said, it's actually a war of perceptions. So this whole attack on Marja, this so-called town of 80,000 people in Afghanistan a few weeks ago, it turns out that it's a collection of villages with a few thousand inhabitants. So we've just been told a complete story that this is a town of 80,000 people under Taliban control, we're taking it back. All nonsense, just made up, just spin.
Okay, so that's the TV debate, which is happening on Thursday week. That's the 22nd of April, and a secret location. At the moment, it's secret anyway, until it's leaked to this programme, chaired by Sky's political editor, Adam Bolton, as one of the three main new-style presidential style TB debates in the run-up to the British general election. Well, coming up in the second half of this hour, we've got Martin McGuinness, Muazzin Beg and Peter Wingard. But before that, Bob Dylan.
We'll be right back.
from his 1983 album, Infidels. That's Bob Dylan. And you may have recognised the guitar on there. That's Dire Straits' Mark Knopfler. It's not one of Dylan's more well-known albums, but it's not a bad track on it, as they always say. Now, one man we didn't hear from last week in last week's special about Irish history and Mo Molum's role in the Good Friday Agreement was the Sinn Féin's Martin McGuinness. What's he saying now the troubles are over? So here he is, speaking at the Bloody Sunday anniversary a few weeks ago about how the peace process is working.
The divisions that were there in the past, particularly in Irish America, over whether or not people supported the armed struggle or not, have now seen a wonderful opportunity for people to come together to support Irish reunification, but to do it now by purely peaceful and democratic means. And that's the challenge that's before us. I think there's no doubt whatsoever that we have made enormous progress. The history of any country is not judged in a year or 2 years, and even our relationship with the DUP, which we've been in now for 2.5 years, I describe it as a fragile plant. But it's a bit stronger now as a result of what happened at Hillsborough. And when you sit back and reflect, as I do on an ongoing basis, with how they work with the DUP and how they try and move the process forward. You know, I often tell people about the first time I sat down with Ian Paisley, and Ian Paisley said to me, and these are his exact words, "Martin, we can rule ourselves. We don't need direct rule ministers coming over from England telling us what to do." And when he said that, for me, that was common ground that we could stand on. And when I look at how Peter Robinson had to deal with the different difficulties that he faced over the course of the last couple of months, he had huge decisions to make around the issue of transfer of power and policing and justice, because he had to face down Jim Allister and the TUV. He had to face down the Ulster Unionists who were opposing the transfer, and he also had to face down very powerful people within his own party, like Gregory Campbell and Willie McRae and Lord Morrow and David Simpson, and even his deputy leader, Nigel Dawes. So I believe as a result of him doing that, that the peace process is stronger, that the political institutions are more stable, and that presents, I think, an even better opportunity for us to continue to forge relationships with all the unionists that are in this building to try and end the divisions that have been so much to our detriment in the past. I think all of that's consistent with the project to bring about Irish unity. So just the last thing to say is thanks to everybody for the ongoing commitment to the struggle. We're all going to go from here to various commemorations all over the country. I'm hopefully going to be in Carrickmore, and others will be in other parts of the country at very, very important commemorations. It's an opportunity for us to renew our commitment to the struggle, to renew our commitment to our primary political objective, and to do so knowing that we are making enormous progress. The last year has seen Sinn Féin, as a result of the European election, become the largest political party in the north. We're now faced into other important elections, the Westminster elections, and a year from now, the Assembly elections. And all of these elections have brought important change. The political landscape has changed in the north forever. The unionist orange state that people knew and hated for 50 years is gone, and we're now in a new dispensation. We're asserting our rights as Irish Republicans, and we're working the agreements that we've made, and we're doing so for the purposes of fulfilling our commitments, but also keeping to the foremost of our minds our primary political objectives. And as Gerry Adams often says, every meeting that we go into, and he and I are going to do another important meeting tomorrow with important people in England, we always know that we're going to end that on our own, that we're accompanied by all of those who have inspired us, whether it be the hunger strikers, the leaders of the 1916 rising, or the volunteers in every part of the north, and indeed every part of the island, who in our generation, the ones that we knew, gave their lives in the legitimate struggle for Irish freedom. Gurra míle maith.
That's the Sinn Féin leader's Martin McGuinness speaking a few weeks ago on the occasion of the anniversary of Bloody Sunday. Now, Martin Summers is joining me. Martin, what do you think of what he had to say there? Is there anything you want to pick up on some of the points he was making?
Well, I mean, two things, really. First of all, the constructive and sensible way he talked about his colleagues in the Democratic Unionist Party, who are his bitter political opponents. I mean, you know, you have Labour Tory niggle here, but they, you know, the Unionists and the Republicans are pretty much at ideological opposite ends of the spectrum in many respects, but they are able to deal with each other because they've got a maturity of approach on both sides, which is what we were highlighting in last week's show. I mean, frankly, I wish English politicians had a half of the gravitas of the Northern Irish politicians from both communities. I mean, we always think of them as being a bit petulant and sort of selfish and narrow-minded. But in actual fact, they have achieved an enormous amount of mutual respect despite their differences. And I think there's a lesson for us on this side of the water there. And the other major point I would make is that they haven't given up their goal of a united Ireland. What they've agreed to do is pursue it through peaceful means. And I think that's got implications, for example, for the Palestine-Israel conflict, where people are saying that they won't talk to Hamas unless they give up their demand for the Israel, that they recognise the state of Israel. And I don't see that you have to recognise the state of Israel to have a ceasefire. I don't see that the Republicans have to give up their idea of a united Ireland one day to participate in politics. They can have that idea. Why not? As long as they pursue it through democratic and peaceful means, they're entitled to believe that that's what they want in the end. And the Unionists are entitled, on the other hand, to say that they don't want it. And then you've just got to agree to disagree. And I think that that's the kind of key to solving a lot of problems, is agree to disagree. What if the Palestinians and the Israelis could just agree to disagree about the recognition of Israel by Hamas? They just disagree about it, but they can still talk to each other. Why not?
He mentioned there that Sinn Féin in the Euro elections were the largest party in the north.
Yes, but don't forget, because they've got a proportional system, there's more than two parties. So when they're saying they're the largest of the five parties.
So is the Unionist vote more divided than the Republican vote then in the...
Effectively, you've got on both sides, you've got the SDLP Sinn Féin on the nationalist side, with the Sinn Féin now becoming the dominant partner on the nationalist side. And you've got the DUP-UUP split on the loyalist side, and this new grouping, True Unionist Vote Voice, or whatever it is, one of the most important.
So are they actually opposing? This is an interesting one, isn't it? Jim Allister, he said there, and the TUV are actually opposing the transfer of policing and justice powers.
Yeah, but at the moment they haven't got a great deal of elected support. There's the North Antrim constituency will be a fight between Ian Paisley Jr., the son of Dr. Ian Paisley, and the TUV candidate, whose name I can't remember. And that's quite a one to watch, because if the TUV are able to overturn Ian Paisley Jr.'s majority, then that might put the peace agreement in jeopardy.
So this is a new party.
If Ian Paisley Jr. can hang on in North Antrim, then I think that's a good sign for the future success of the agreement.
So this is a new party on the Unionist side. What does it stand for again?
Well, they're basically...
What does TUV actually first
of all
stand
for? True Unionist Voice.
Oh, okay. What's their sort of position?
If I could put it like this, they're the mirror image of the Republican dissidents on the other side that don't want to accept the deal. I think that, as I said last week, the Republican dissidents are wrong, but I think also the TUV are wrong. I think the DUP are to be congratulated for doing a deal with the nationalists. It was not easy for them to do. A lot of their people are very conservative and rather, traditional in their outlook, but they have risen to the occasion and in actual fact been prepared to do a deal which the Ulster Unionists have prevaricated about, who are supposedly more moderate. And I think that I'd just like to say, I don't suppose there's many DUP people listening to our programme, but that kind of constructive attitude will not go unnoticed, is not going unnoticed, and it will stand you in good stead. You can see the respect that you've got from the other side for taking that kind of stand, and that kind of mutual respect is the way forward. It is the future for Ireland, let's hope.
Well, this latest development of devolution of policing and justice is nearly finished now, nearly about, it's very, very soon going to happen, apparently in the beginning of May. Why is it so important, this business of policing and justice? Because, essentially it means that Sinn Féin will be getting their hands on police files that... from the days of the Troubles.
Well, no, not necessarily. It doesn't work quite like that. I mean, but obviously policing and justice is central to resolving the issues. I mean, policing and justice have been at the heart of the battle all the way down the line. I mean, as we said last week, the RUC at one stage were leading loyalist mobs to attack Catholic areas. The RUC no longer exists. It's the Police Service of Northern Ireland. And in actual fact, the main danger for them at the moment, for their Catholic police officers, is assassination by Republican dissidents. But they've got 40% of their membership are now from the nationalist community. All of the major parties are supporting the Police Service of Northern Ireland to do a proper job, an impartial job, and that is very, very important, that all sectors of the community can have faith and confidence that the Police Service will be impartial and will uphold the law impartially, and that was a lot of the problem in the first place.
And finally, the Savile inquiry, which is this final and very thorough inquiry into Bloody Sunday after the first whitewash inquiry, was due to be out any time now. Why has it still not come out?
Well, I presume there are political sensitivities with what's in the report. It's basically been delayed until after the election. We can't really second-guess what's in it, but I imagine it's going to be fairly critical of the government and fairly critical of the army. So, you know, it's been put on the back burner so as not to cause political ruckus in the run-up to the election, I suspect.
Thanks, Martin. Now, on to a police bookshop raid back in the early part of this decade, nearly 10 years ago, in fact, on British ex-Guantanamo prisoner Mizen Begg's Birmingham bookshop. Sam Ibrahim raises the ugly spectre of police corruption in connection with the raid in the early hours of the morning of the Al-Ansar bookshop in Balsall Heath. The police told the press they believed Mizen Begg and others connected with the bookshop had $100,000 from Hezbollah on the bookshop premises. When it turned out there was no $100,000 from Hezbollah, but on the contrary, after the police raid, £400 was missing from the till, the police's first reaction was to tell the press there was a risk of a bomb and to get them to go back to the far end of the street so that there would be no reporting on this embarrassing development. Anyway, this shocking tale can now be told in full by a friend of the Begg family, Sam Ibrahim.
My name is Sami Ibrahim. I live in Balsall Heath, Birmingham. And one of the local bookstores used to be called Al-Ansar, owned by a guy called Mizen Begg, who ended up going to Guantanamo for about 5 years. He just been released about a year ago. The local police came to the bookstore about 4 o'clock in the morning. The media's there, and they searched the bookstore. And then one of the officers leaked information. I think it was deliberate, obviously, that this the officers find a gun and $100,000 from Hezbollah, as the officer said.
So is this the anti-terror police or the local police?
The local police. And what happened is we discovered that the truth is that one of the officers did stole £400 from the guy Till. He demanded that whoever take the money to give the money back. That's according to the owner, obviously. That's what he said. And they went back again and put the money back, and the guy was actually released and nothing happened. You know, everything in the morning was back to normal.
So how did he notice that the money had been stolen, the bookshop owner?
Well, obviously he went to walk in after the search to check that everything in the place, you know, because they have no ground to arrest him, they find nothing. So he said, well, before you go, I need to check my bookstore. According to him, he looked at the till the night before, the evening before. He knows that he left that much money in the till. He find the money is not there. From the evening till 4 o'clock in the morning, nobody entered the bookstore other than him and the officers that time. So that's the reason he actually know that one of the officers picks up the money.
So how was this incident reported?
Well, there's no report to this incident because the only bit was reported is the first leaking of that who find a gun, £100,000.
But, I mean, you've got the press everywhere. Surely a bookshop owner had a chance to talk to the press?
Well, the press wasn't interested in that because, obviously, they, as you know, they labelled him that, well, he must be one of the Qaeda or Islamist, and you know how they stereotype. So that's part of the story. They wasn't interested in that. They run away with the first part, which is first thing in the morning you see in the media, Maktaba Ansar, which is bookstore Ansar, Ladyville Road. Police find a gun and $100,000 from Hezbollah. And this is what we call it unfair reporting, where you take part of the story and you demonize the book store owner, and obviously the truth is not being shown to the public what really happened, that the police find nothing there, and one of their officers or whoever you call it is one of their is a thief.
So how has this affected the trade at the bookstore?
Well, he actually closed down after that because people pointing fingers, you know. As you know, the media more, well, people more convinced a lot by the media, not true, you know, why they printed out first page, he must have done something. And he closed down.
So is there anything we can do about this kind of thing with, should we say, bad actions by the police and the press?
Well, I think there should be a kind of a review, maybe a newsletter where people pick up news on the local media and check them out. So obviously, if it's not true, then you put the other point of view, that this is what the police is saying, but this is the shopkeeper. You know, in each incident would be different person. For example, this is the truth, and police should be called. Is that what really happened? Police say, no. Who said that? The media, oh, no, wouldn't find anything. Well, if the police be recorded saying that not true, wouldn't find anything, then this should be published. You know, surely the mainstream media will not kind of publish that, but then we could say we could have a kind of review. You know, a person like you working for a radio could have a review to the, like weekly review to all the news. So we will be keen to know what is your response to all this media stories, knowing that you are kind of person who call and investigate. You know, I think that's the only way you can tackle it.
Well, that was Sam Ibrahim there talking to me recently about the police's late-night raid on released Guantanamo prisoner Muazzin Beg and his family's Birmingham bookshop nearly 10 years ago. And I just will point out, because he was talking about good sources for news about little leaked stories like this, which tell you that what we were originally told by the press wasn't true, and that's a website called CAMPAC. That's Campaign Against Criminalising Communities. That's www.campacc.org.uk. That's Campaign Against Criminalising Communities. And they do a little newsletter you can sign up to, and plus they have a load of news on their website. Now, but Martin, let's just get your comments on this quickly. Do you think the police are a little bit too close to the press in incidents like this?
Well, I mean, there's an awful lot of bad practice uncovered by that little interview, wasn't there? And, you know, these kind of things will be happening, and we've got to be vigilant to make sure that they don't. I mean, the rule book must be followed.
But it clearly isn't there? I mean, is there a question of, you know, who is policing the police? I mean, we had another story this week, actually, which is criticising the independent so-called police complaints authority.
Well, I think it's very interesting how these kind of decisions to make these kind of raids are made. If you remember a few years ago when the chap was shot in East London, he came down the stairs and the
Forest Gate.
Forest Gate. And as I understand, that in actual fact, the Metropolitan Police had no evidence against these guys whatsoever. The security services came to them and said, oh, these guys are dangerous chemical weapons bombers. And the Metropolitan Police said, well, we haven't got anything on these guys. And they were assured by the security services that they were a very, very dangerous threat. So the Metropolitan Police turned up mob-handed to raid the house. You know, hundreds of police, literally armed police. And of course, they're all on edge because they think they're armed and they've got bombs and all the rest of it, and they shoot him and nearly killed him. But it turns out that the police had no evidence against these people at all. And that just goes to show how elements within the security forces, I won't put it any stronger than that, are able to steer the whole police force in the wrong direction. The police are kept at the lowest level of the information chain. They're just told, go and get this guy, he's a danger. What we really need is the police to be in charge of the investigations all along the line, so that they know who they're after and stop being misled by the security forces, who have links to Islamist terrorism. We know that Al-Majah Haroon and these other extremist groups set up camp in London in the 1980s during the war in Afghanistan, which we were talking about in the first hour. And the reason why we've got all these Islamist groups in Britain is because MI6 were the lead agency for funneling young boys to go and fight in Afghanistan. That's the history. So we've got a historical dimension to Islamic terrorism linked to Western intelligence services. That's why we need independent police investigations.
Well, I also have to say, well, actually, I don't have to say anything, but I will say that the press is being rather too gullible here. If they're told to go down the other end of the street because there might be a bomb, then, or there is a bomb by the police, they're just simply being lied to. Then they should be reporting that afterwards, the fact that they have been lied to. Anyway, on to our next final item for today. Legendary British actor Peter Wingard is synonymous with some of the best British crime dramas ever. Until his 1970s fall from grace under a charge of indecency in the toilets of Cheltenham bus station, Wingard brought presence, style and pizzazz to every stage or film set he worked on. One of his most famous roles was alongside Diana Rigg as the leader of a satanic cult which included senior politicians and establishment figures, modelled on the 18th century Hellfire Club, in classic black and white Avengers episode A Touch of Brimstone. Wingard was the partner of Alan Bates for many years, and in his 60s heyday was given starring roles in two great British TV dramas, Department S and Jason King. 2 weeks ago, the Mail on Sunday published photos of him in the street in London. But what has Peter Wingard got to say about the state of modern TV drama? Here he is giving some creative insight into one of the great Jason King episodes. It's called Variations on a Theme, which was shot in Vienna in 1969.
This is Peter Wingard. I play Jason King in Jason King. Variations on a Theme reminds me of my early days in television. I was asked to do a serial after playing Sidney Carton in a serial of A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens, and was somewhat surprised to be given only the first two episodes of a seven-parter. I found out later the reason was because it hadn't been written. Even more disconcerting for some of the cast was the director's total disregard of what had been written, and he asked us to improvise. A real pioneer, a man after my own heart. I, of course, was in channel heaven. It was quite frightening, but an exciting and innovative way of making live television. Big Brother, eat your heart out. The first episode was sedately received, but after that, when we'd thrown away the script, it got bigger and bigger viewing ratings, and towards the end had not only the viewers on cliffhanger, but had us on tender hooks as well. None of us had a remote idea of what was to happen next. I was, of course, the villain, and had been blown up in the second episode, but kept coming back by popular demand, of course, for the next one. I remember the last shot. I was my inevitable demise, but as the flames from the explosion, sixth one, I think, a little question mark appeared above the wreckage and grew and grew and grew until it filled the whole screen. And that was the end. It was wonderful. The series was called, and by far the best literary contribution to it, Epilogue to Capricorn. I suggested to our producers on Jason King that as I and the director Cyril Frankel both adored Vienna so much that we took Frank Watts with us and shot as much incidental footage as possible within, say, a fortnight. Then show all to our prospective writers and see what they could come up with.
Yes.
A la Epilogue to Capricorn.
If I can, I will.
Amazingly enough, they agreed. And off we went. On the very first day of our arrival in Vienna, I suggested we make for the huge cartwheel, which was then famous as our, what's it called? The London Eye, though not as unfavourably. You may remember it figured in that Sir Carol Reed master thriller, The Third Man, starring Orson Welles. Frank had a handheld cam, unheard of then in use for drama, and he was behind me, and I walked towards the big wheel. As we got there, just by it was a model replica, giving all the most unnecessary statistics for its working mechanism. Something suddenly made me glance to the left, more likely Cyril Frankel, sotto voce. There was no sound on camera, as he must have seen this man first. He and Frank swear it was not a plant, but there, in the identical hat and long black overcoat, was Orson Welles, as he was as Harry Lime, the drug-dealing extortionist in the Carol Reed film, The Third Man. And he was walking towards me with that quizzical smile when he delivered those unforgettable lines in the lift, looking down on the ant-like creatures below and the huge cartwheel which I was now standing next to. A thousand years of war, destruction and famine produced Michelangelo, Da Vinci, and Galileo's famous telescope. 2,000 years of peace and tranquility in Switzerland. And what did that produce? The yes, cuckoo clock.
This is very urgent.
Goodbye, Collie.
Your friend Alan Kiegel.
And he disappeared. And I was about to meet him here, face to face. The resemblance in my peripheral sight was eerie. So I pretended to be engrossed with the statistics of the replica model. At first, Orson Welles gingerly moved round me, as if summing up the right moment to pounce, which he did suddenly, and looking at me with those twinkling eyes, rolled up his sleeve to expose a series of cheap gold-plated watches. You want? I give you a good... I've gone into low grade. Sorry. How am I done? Do you want? You want? I give you a good price. He purred. I believe some of all this is in the film, so I hope I won't spoil it for you. My idea was to make a film as a complimentary pastiche of The Third Man, especially as this live model replica of Orson Welles came so suddenly to hand. The other joy in Vienna was coming across a gaggle of nuns coming down some ancient stairs and Jason's suddenly running up them. As I haven't seen this completed variations on a theme, I do hope they kept those two episodes in and find out if they worked. What I do know is that it was, of course, directed by Cyril Frankel, written by Philip Broadley, filmed on location by Frank Watts, and guest starring Michael Glover, Alexandra Bastido, Della Crane and the late Ralph Bates, Siobhan Quillen, Magda Konopka. Who said filming isn't fun? It is.
Help yourself to a drink.
If you don't have to watch yourself.
No, that's mine. Let me give you...
As a postscript,
it won't poison me, Colonel.
One of the most international successes was The Avengers. That was all studio, with minor forays into lanes around Elstree Studios. But The Avengers set was a never-never land. It was contained in its own and very special reality, which Mrs. Peel and John Steed controlled with supreme elegance and style. Style so sorely lacking in our present-day television. Another name for it is imagination.
That was famous, legendary in some ways, British actor Peter Wingard there, still alive and well, as you can hear, and living in London. I do agree with him on the state of modern TV drama, I have to say. Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next, the Sky News at 7. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time each week here on BCFM 93.2, where our Barton Hill transmitter will be bringing you investigative reports and discussing some of the big stories in Bristol, Britain and around the world. If you have a story for us, questions about this evening's programme, or you know the location of the Sky TV debate on Thursday week, please do get in touch via our webpage, which is thisweek.org.uk. We'll take you straight there, or else you can email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks very much to this week's guest in the first hour. That was the chair of Bristol City Council's Sustainable Development and Transport Scrutiny Committee and councillor for Bedminster, deputy leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council, Mark Bradshaw. Thanks also to our resident Old Labour pundit and Oxford economist, Martin Summers. Next week at 5 on Friday Drive Time, we'll be joined by deputy leader of the council, That is Lib Dem Councillor for Clifton East, Simon Cook. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all previous Friday drive times, including my hour-long report on mobile phone masts and wireless safety, our investigation into leadership charity Common Purpose, as well as last week's special on the Good Friday Agreement and Irish history at bcfm.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.